Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
We have put together a fantastic show for you today. Bob Kessler, executive producer, is here right now to tell us more.
Something, Robert, that, well, most animals do, but especially cows do, that we need them to stop is belching. Not only is it rude, but it does contribute to carbon emissions. So we'll meet an entrepreneur who might have a solution. And we also keep hearing about all the stuff that climate change is going to mess up. Well, this one might actually get people's attention. It could ruin the internet.
All coming up on this edition of Green Sense. The livestock industry is responsible for nearly 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions, according to the UN. One way to reduce those emissions is to help cattle, buffalo, sheep, and goats burp less. Bezoar Laboratories in Texas is working on how to do that, and we're joined by Elizabeth Latham, President and CFO. Elizabeth, welcome to Green Sense.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth, how do you know that when livestock burp, it creates greenhouse gas emissions?
So we have a variety of ways of measuring this. We can put them into chambers that then runs through what's known as a gas chromatograph that measures the greenhouse gases directly. We've known for a long time that this was happening. It's only been really in the last 30 years that it started to get a lot of attention in terms of trying to reduce these emissions themselves.
What makes animals like cattle burp as much as they do?
So it comes down to what's known as the rumen. So cows have one stomach with four chambers, and the largest is known as the rumen. Within that, there is a diverse microbial population of bacteria, archaea, yeast, protists. And so when they eat grass, these microorganisms break it down through fermentation, similar to what is done biochemically to make beer or wine. And that is also very gaseous as well. It just so happens that the particular group of microorganisms known as archaea are what known as our methanogens. And so they take H2 and CO2 and they can turn it into methane in an energy generating process. And then this comes out of the front and the back end of the animal. It's really helpful for the animal. It increases their fermentative efficiency. So it basically allows them to make as much meat and milk as they do, but it kind of has this dark side, and that being climate change.
What inspired you to work on this particular problem?
So it started with my PhD in animal science. I have a passion for agriculture, and I love a good steak. I love a good ice cream cone, and I wanted to kind of looking to see what sort of solutions there we could find that would help the planet, because I am a lifelong environmentalist, but also help the farmers and ranchers who are working with these animals.
Well, how did you discover that certain probiotics would help reduce the gas emissions?
So I went into the rumen itself and started isolating a lot of different microbes that live there naturally and see which ones were sort of antagonistic to the other microbes that made methane.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Latham with Bezoar Laboratories in Texas on how burping livestock can increase greenhouse gas emissions. Have you measured how much gas comes out of these different varieties of livestock?
Yeah, we've measured cows quite a bit. Mostly we focus on beef steers, but in the next year, we're going to start working with dairy animals as well.
Well, can you put that in context or perspective? You know, how much greenhouse gas emissions does an average cow produce?
I think it's about 1 kilogram of CO2 equivalent a day, basically. So it's like burning about 10 gallons of gasoline a day.
That's significant.
Yeah, it really is.
And how much do you think you could reduce that by using these probiotics?
50%. So we're hoping in about 5 years to get our product in the hands of about 20% of cows, which will be the equivalent of removing all the cars off of the Californian roads.
That's amazing. Like a lot of problems, what took so long to discover that this was a problem and to come up with a possible solution?
Well, there's a little bit of a bottleneck between science and the real world. There's not a lot of scientists that want to go into the business world, and then a lot of business people don't have scientific inclination. So I'm kind of trying to bridge that gap a little bit and speed up the process. We also have a really intensive FDA regulatory process that any new products need to go through. And then there's just the science itself. It takes years and years and years and years and years of research to prove safety and efficacy of any new technologies, especially when it's going in the food chain and we want to make sure that it's not going to hurt the animal or the people that are consuming them.
We always like to look at the cost benefit of environmental solutions. It's great that you could reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50%, but what is the cost for applying these probiotics, and is there any commercial benefit for you doing it?
Yeah, though that's a great question. So because it's a microorganism, it's really easy to produce. You can just use industrial fermenters. So we're able to sell it to the producers for a fairly minimal amount and still make a little bit of money, still be an actual business. And then the producers themselves, they get an increase in feed efficiency from the animal. So they're not actually being hurt financially by helping the planet.
That's what we like to hear.
Yeah. So you can kind of have your cake and eat it too, or have your steak and save the planet too.
Well, you're based in Texas, where everyone likes a good steak, and 13% of all cattle in the U.S. are raised. Are you hoping that cattle and other livestock all start using your probiotics to reduce emissions?
Absolutely. I mean, we're hoping to launch in Texas first because of the, you know, it's the number one cattle producing state. And then from there, we have our eyes on California, then the rest of the country. And then we're really thinking global of this as well. We're working on international collaborations. So we're really excited to have this be an industry standard is our goal.
What is your biggest challenge and obstacle to grabbing 100% market share?
Let's see. I don't know. I think we're pretty confident. I mean, the FDA regulation is going to be a little bit of an uphill battle, but we're confident we're going to get through that. And then from there, I don't know. I think sometimes farmers and ranchers can be a little reluctant to try new products, but if we have some good conversations with consultants and veterinarians and them directly, we can show them the economic benefits. I think we have a real win on our hands, but we'll see.
Confidence is a big part of success, and last year you were awarded the Young Entrepreneurs Award from Unilever. How has that helped you with your company's development and in solving this issue?
Oh, so Unilever has been a big help. We've been in contact with a lot of their sustainability directors to basically work collaboratively from that point on, and then they also introduced us to some other corporate sponsors that are sort of taking us under their wing to help us with distribution and manufacturing. And then, yeah, that was kind of like the beginning of our sort of momentum over the last year, was winning that award and making those corporate connections.
You're working on reducing methane for animals. Could this possibly have any human application?
Yeah, so methane actually does hurt human GI tracts as well. It leads to constipation and weight gain, and is even associated with certain cancers. We have thought about that, but most people that we talk to are not super keen to take a microorganism that was originally isolated from the stomach of a cow. But we are looking at other sort of technologies that might be able to help with methane in the guts of humans and pigs and chickens, because, well, you know, everybody farts, so we're all part of the problem of climate change, and it hurts our GI tract as well.
Anything else you'd like to share with us? Anything we didn't know about cows that maybe you could tell us?
Let's see. Fun cow fact. Did you know that cows can have best friends?
No, I didn't. What are those? BBFCs?
They bond with one another. So if you track herd behavior, you'll find that one cow is always with the other cow, and it's sort of their equivalent of a best friend.
Well, thanks for sharing that fun fact and all the other information you did, and we wish you the best of luck.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That's Elizabeth Latham with Baser Laboratories. You can listen and subscribe to the Green Sense podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. Takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you. Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
climate change could impact national defense, destroy our homes, make the weather uncomfortable, damage our economy, make food scarcer. But how's this for getting your attention? It could ruin the internet. That's what's being explored in a new study co-authored by Paul Barford, a professor with the computer science department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Paul, welcome to Green Sense.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you.
Amazing topic. I'm amazed what climate change can impact. What makes the internet particularly vulnerable to climate change?
Well, I don't know that it's any more or less vulnerable than other infrastructures. It's an infrastructure that we all rely on a daily basis. And the aspect that we consider in our study is the fact that there are a lot of people and businesses that are located very close to shorelines in the United States. And we simply wondered how they might be impacted by sea level rise that is predicted in the models that have been developed that relate to climate change.
So how would sea level rise impact the internet?
Yeah, that's exactly the research question that we addressed. And it takes just a second of background to understand the internet in order to answer the question. The internet fundamentally is an infrastructure, communication infrastructure that relies on connectivity between populated areas. So the signals that we send have to be carried by some kind of a medium. And in this day and age, that medium is principally optical fiber. So there's lots and lots of optical fiber that's deployed underground between major cities and within major cities and even small cities. And because of the fact that people like to live near the oceans, all of that infrastructure for communication that's deployed underground is potentially at risk due to sea level rise.
Have we ever seen disruption of the internet from sea level rise?
Well, there have certainly been climate change-related events, the major hurricanes that have escalated, hurricane events that have escalated over the last 20 years have caused significant outages in certain areas. So, of course, we're all very familiar with Katrina and Sandy and some of the others. But perhaps the most immediate effect that users probably haven't felt directly is the impingement on landing points for submarine cables that are getting closer and closer to being underwater when they were never meant to be underwater. So it's a little bit hard to wrap your head around just from the standpoint that you say, well, the submarine cable must be safe underwater. Yes, that's true. But the issue is where they actually connect to non-submarine cables above the water.
What about coronal mass ejection? I would think that electromagnetic storms might have a bigger impact on the internet than rising sea levels.
Well, I mean, that's certainly possible. That is an issue that has been considered by scientists. But of course, the issue of our study is that we don't want to get to a point where some years from now things are very bad. We have massive communication outages and someone looks back and says, why didn't somebody tell us that, you know, we were going to have to deal with sea level rise and that it would have an impact on the internet? And so what we're trying to do is to shine a light on risks and ensure that we're well situated to preserve the wonderful communication capability that we have in the internet in the years to come.
Well, I commend you for your foresight because a lot of times things that are hiding in plain sight are overlooked. So we might think at first about all the entertaining things that would go away if we lost the internet, like movies and music streaming and social media. But this would create much larger problems beyond that. What are some of the repercussions of losing the internet beyond just this fun stuff that I mentioned?
One of the things that I think is important to highlight is that our study points to risks. What we've done is a risk analysis and shined a light on the areas of the U.S. in particular that are at highest risk due to sea level rise. The next step in our work is actually to consider the issue of impact of sea level rise. Namely, if the seas do indeed rise in the way that is projected, what kinds of bad things are likely to happen because of that? And while we haven't completed that study, the things that are obvious are that we will have the possibility of very localized effect that won't have any impact, for example, on someone like me sitting in Madison, Wisconsin, but it will have an impact on people in local coastal areas. But there is also the possibility of much larger impacts because of the fact that a lot of coastal infrastructure is actually used to carry communication signals across the country and across the world. And if we have damage or outages to those major aspects of internet infrastructure, then there can be not only damage to communication directly, but also the potential for having impact on other critical infrastructures that rely on the internet. So, you know, things like the power grid or air traffic control or other important infrastructures that we all rely on. So it's these kinds of effects that we're studying in our current work.
My guest is Paul Barford, a professor with the Computer Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we're talking about how climate change can impact the internet. Well, Paul, we like to be very solution-oriented. We talked a little bit about the problems and what may occur. What are the solutions?
Well, that's another great question, and that's another issue that that we look forward to considering in our work. We're sort of taking things step by step by first identifying risks in our current paper, then considering the potential impact of the risks, and then finally developing methods for mitigating these risks. So that's our sort of three-step process. And the final step in the process is, of course, something that has to be considered by a number of stakeholders. So researchers like our group can potentially provide perspective. Service providers who actually own and operate the infrastructure will obviously have a big say. And then, of course, the municipalities that are indicated in our studies will also have an important role in developing mitigation strategies. There are three basic tenets, though, that are fairly obvious based on the work that we've done for addressing these effects. The first is to harden infrastructure where it makes sense to do so, namely to make it more resilient or potentially impervious to seawater. The second is to redeploy infrastructure, namely to essentially wave goodbye to what we currently have and deploy new infrastructure much further inland. And the third possibility is to take advantage of certain capabilities within the internet that exist today to reroute our communication traffic to utilize other infrastructure.
Paul, do you think the internet being in jeopardy will help people to take the climate change risk more seriously?
Well, I hope so. You know, I borrow a line from or an idea from a colleague of mine, and I say that I'm a climate change skeptic. I've looked at the data, and I actually think things are much worse than is currently being reported. The issues are ones that that must be taken seriously by people. And, you know, again, as a computer scientist, my area of expertise is communications and communication systems, protocols, and infrastructure. So my job is to think carefully about how we can make improvements. And if improvements are in the face of threats like climate change, then, you know, hopefully I'll be able to develop new methods, tools, and deployment strategies that allow us to address these risks.
For many, the internet has become as accessible as turning on a light switch. It's just there. Do people doubt your findings or even question why you're researching this based on that experience?
That is it's a very interesting insight. The internet, I think, for a lot of people is kind of like magic. And I think it's important for people to understand that it's actually the largest and most complex infrastructure that's ever been built by man. It spans the globe. It's composed of tens of thousands of networks that include millions of devices, and it's used by billions of people every day. We rely on it in our daily lives intrinsically. And if things go wrong in the internet, people feel it immediately and they get very upset if things don't work. So, you know, it's critical. It's been designed from the start to be very resilient, but it's critical to ensure that it continues to operate in a way that facilitates our day-to-day activities. And this is something that, you know, a lot of people spend time thinking about. And this climate change issue, I think, is something new. And, you know, hopefully it will spur people to spend more time considering, you know, what we need to do to preserve the capability that we enjoy today. By the way, you know, the how the internet works is something that, you know, that I teach in my classes. I'm very happy to be able to teach it because I really enjoy it. And kind of lifting the lid on the complexity is something that a lot of students enjoy.
Paul, we appreciate that you've taken this serious, and there's people like you that are guardians and stewards of the internet. So thank you for sharing your insight. I never would have thought of this, and hopefully we could raise awareness about the internet and its vulnerability. Thanks for being on Green Sense.
Well, it's my great pleasure, and thanks so much for your time.
That's Paul Barford, a professor with the Computer Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about the internet being in jeopardy because of climate change. This is Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to Green Sense. You could subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. We searched the globe to find really good guests to entertain you and to inform you. Bob, who did you find that will dazzle us with their brilliance and the innovative ideas for the next week's show?
Well, this is one innovation we covered just a couple weeks ago, are these offshore wind farms that are starting to come to the U.S. in places like the coast of Massachusetts. Well, there are other coasts in the interior of the U.S., and those could be the site for big new offshore wind farms. So we'll find out about a new project coming up to the Great Lakes region.
Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air the show. Thanks for listening to this edition of Green Sense. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.